weather and climate often cause concern and curiosity, but understanding the facts behind the phenomena can be a challenge. We're here to help. From the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Illinois Public Media, welcome to Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the skies above Illinois and the world.
I'm your host, Steve Nesbitt, head of the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Did you know that over 41 million Americans speak Spanish at home? But weather news and climate information is primarily reported in English. So what happens when severe weather warnings are not understood? What happens when the severity of a tornado or a thunderstorm isn't clearly translated or understood by our communities? Speaking with us today on the connection between weather and language is Joseph Trujillo Falcon, assistant professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences. He leads the Advancing Language Equity and Resilience in the Atmospheric Sciences Lab, known as ALERTAS, which focuses on improving weather communications to non-English communities. Welcome to Weather Realness, Joseph.
Thank you so much, Steve. I'm so happy to be here and really advocate for these multilingual groups.
So can you tell us what the challenges are for people in non-English communities? I mean, we receive weather information on our phones, from the news, from the newspaper. How do they access weather information and warnings?
You know, it really depends on the multilingual community at hand, but I think we need to start off with the fundamentals. A lot of multilingual communities either are not from the United States or do not have a disaster subculture that kind of gets them to understand these kinds of extreme weather events. I'd like to provide a personal example. I was born in Lima, Peru, and moved to the United States when I was 5 years old. Growing up, I heard from my grandparents stories about earthquakes and how to stay safe against them. Never in my life did I hear anything about a tornado or a hail event. So that the second that I stepped here in the United States, oh my goodness, it was kind of a shock just to see all of it unfold. And with that in mind, the fact that even to this present day, there's no English to Spanish weather and climate dictionary in the United States. We have yet to establish official terminology for even some weather terms. It only amplifies these challenges in reaching the most vulnerable in disasters, because time and time again, we've noted that the forecast can be as accurate as can be, but if it's not understood in the language that individual or community member understands it in, then they simply do not receive it nor engage with it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a common problem even for native English speakers, not understanding the scientific context, right? And so it's sort of just like adding on another layer that complicates things for people.
For sure.
So within the Spanish-speaking community, who are the most vulnerable people in being affected by the lack of multilingual weather forecasting?
First off, definitely those that are limited English proficient. Really, they depend mainly on multilingual information for life-saving actions. It's also immigrants that are not used to the kind of weather extremes that are experienced here in the United States, that even if they were to receive a theoretical translated message, they may not know necessarily what a tornado means. Something I always like to highlight is just how beautiful and diverse language is, but also how complicated it can make weather messaging. An example I like to always showcase is in Arabic. The word tornado and hurricane is actually the same word in that language, really more indicating a rotating column of wind. And so if we can't really explain and describe that hazard in nature to the community member, how can we ever expect them to take it seriously? It's those two angles here that are really important as we consider the most vulnerable in this context.
And I think your research has shown that there's inconsistencies between things that we sort of take for granted in English that might map to different sort of mental maps in different languages, right? Can you talk a little bit about that?
100%. You know, this all started as a big conversation back in 1987 with a big tornado that was approaching Zaragoza, Texas.
An F4 tornado, an EF5 by today's standards, tore through the small West Texas town of Zaragoza. It caused devastation as far as the eye could see.
That day, the Zaragoza tornado became one of the deadliest in Texas history. 20 minutes before the twister struck, the Weather Service issued a tornado warning. And even though the warning was broadcast, many didn't hear it because most residents listened to radio stations from Mexico.
And there was a radio announcer at the time trying to translate tornado warning into Spanish, but realized there was not a direct translation of the word warning. depending on where you're from or how you're raised in Latin America for a Spanish speaker, you speak a very different dialect, a regional variety of the language, to where that term could actually get translated in 5 to 6 different ways. And some of my research has really delved into this to study the sociolinguistic nuances of language and how that also affects how people perceive risk and make sense of it. We actually tested the current National Weather Service tornado watch and warning terminology that is currently being used present day, and we found that people actually think that an advisory is riskier than a warning because that translation is not communicating the urgency in Spanish. The word for tornado warning in Spanish as of right now is aviso de tornado, which essentially is more of rather a soft pat on the back rather than you need to go seek shelter immediately. And so that's something we've been studying and really trying to find more dialect neutral ways that no matter where you come from, you're still able to engage and truly understand this information.
Right. And even, for example, the difference in the word weather versus climate. Right. If you go to different countries, they're using different terminology.
Yeah. I mean, we can go back to the fundamentals of it all. Even in Spanish, weather and climate usually is just said as clima, and it's used interchangeably. And really here, even in the United States, there's been instances where some media markets have taken advantage of that to spread some kind of misinformation to say that climate change is not real, and saying that, weather and climate are the same thing because technically it's the same word, and have been trying to frame it in that sort of way. I've heard instances, and it's NBC reported that radio stations across the Southeast sometimes were using that to spread that sort of misinformation. So yes, this language nuance can also be used to spread misinformation as well, which is why I believe it's so critical to really establish a threshold and establish a objective way to communicate this in languages other than English, because this is only one instance of many.
It seems like there's a sort of a little bit of a vacuum of information for a lot of people. How do some of these communities that you study get weather information, and how might it be different from the channels that we use as English speakers?
Yeah, you know, even in warning communication research, it's always been that we really rely on a lot of these official sources, like government agencies, broadcast meteorologists, for example, for this life-saving information. But my research has really found that, especially in multilingual communities where that information may not be able to be provided by an official quote-unquote agency, they really more rely on community leaders. One instance is where we did interviews with survivors of the December 10th to 11th, 2021 tornado outbreak.
Starting the night of December 10th, at least 59 twisters carved through 10 states, a swarm you wouldn't expect 2 weeks before winter. The storm threw down one twister that cut a path of destruction of more than 165 miles. One meteorologist we talked with called that tornado the beast.
We found in those instances that they were not tuning in to the local television station, nor even looking at the National Weather Service. They were asking their local community leaders that did not have any meteorological expertise, but were people that have built trust in their community over time. So, for example, in Arkansas, there was a big Hispanic center there where they helped the local immigrant community out with translation services, health services during the pandemic, that when that time came along, they also trusted them for tornado information. And so how we've been trying to engage these folks in the future is really to reimagine how we can distribute information across various kinds of mediums to reach these community leaders. Maybe they need to be just as much of an integrated weather partner as some of these official agencies may be in the future.
And I think the event that you're talking about is the event that impacted Paducah, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And can you talk a little bit more about how specific communities may have been impacted by the language barrier?
That event really opened my eyes to really go out and talk to these tornado survivors because for the most part, there's no Telemundo or Univision station in Paducah. And so a lot of these people were not even aware that a severe thunderstorm event was happening, despite broadcasters really putting it out there in English just days before the event. And so for a lot of them, when they heard the sirens wail all across town, that was the first time they ever heard of a tornado even happening. And I remember talking to an emergency manager in Bowling Green, Kentucky. They told me that just the tornado track itself directly impacted people that spoke over 15 different languages. That was just the tornado track itself. And one language in particular that really captivated my interest, and really that I've been working on to expand stuff in, is indigenous languages as well. We know we think about Spanish in Latin America, something the language that a lot of people speak. But specifically, there was one community from Guatemala where they spoke an indigenous language, Quiche. And it was like a game of telephone, where the school administrators would translate it from English to Spanish to the children, and then the children would have to translate it from Spanish to Quiché to the community. And just like in any game of telephone, the message can get lost, and it sure did.
Yeah, and I think that particular event impacted the town of Mayfield, mm-hmm. and a lot of the people in a particular factory were a very diverse group of people, and they were relying on their employer at work for the weather information, and apparently was not communicated very well. It caused a lot of problems.
Yeah, and my research team has really been trying to tackle this explicitly. One of my graduate students, Elizabeth de Jesus Otero, led a field campaign just this last summer to go visit communities in Kansas in farm worker employment settings to really understand how currently decision-making is being made during extreme weather events. For example, OSHA has suggested guidance on what to do when if extreme weather were to arrive, but there's not anything concrete and to be able to move forward and tell them that they have to do something. And so we really got to learn some insights in that. And I think it's a wonderful conversation to move on to the future, not just for Spanish speakers, but really for everybody on how we can stay safe in our workplaces with all of this extreme weather.
So if you're just joining us, this is Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate from Illinois Public Media and the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I'm Steve Nesbitt, head of the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois. We're talking about the importance of multilingual weather forecasting with Joseph Trujillo-Falcón, assistant professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois. So you mentioned a little bit earlier about cultural differences that might impact who people trust. And of course, here in the United States, we're very fortunate to have really a world-class weather agency that's putting out all of these warnings. They strive to warn everybody, and this may differ a little bit in other countries, right? So can you talk a little bit about what people in different countries might have inherited between their relationship with government agencies and following directions versus what we take for granted here in the United States?
You know, I've had the opportunity to interview community members about this, and some of them have closer connections. For example, in Mexico, El Servicio Meteorológico Nacional, SMN, is their National Weather Service equivalent. People, especially in coastal communities, have engaged with them a lot, especially through hurricane events, and they're really more used to that warning framework. But even in the same country, areas in the mountainous areas of Mexico, they haven't really engaged with that agency as much. So it really just depends on the geography and what kind of weather they've been experiencing. That's one example. But then there's others across Central America where the meteorological agency is such a small office that it doesn't really have much outreach out there. And then when you look in South America, the limited sparse radar coverage across countries in South America also have limited the ability for the National Weather Service to truly engage with the community. As noted in Brazil by some of these tornadoes that happened just this last year that caught a lot of community members off guard. And so, yeah, a lot of people or most likely, for the most part, do not engage with their National Weather Service agencies, not because they don't want to, but because of limited resources. And so they come in here with a very new warning system. And that's something that in the communication space I've been really trying to delve into and theorize about, because a communication theory, we've actually been able to understand how people adapt to a new country and how they really apply some of their own cultural backgrounds and really adapt to that new culture. But a lot can be said about weather cultures, climate cultures, and see how they adapt to that so that we can better tailor information for them in the future.
So, Joseph, your work has driven policy across the National Weather Service and NOAA, which is the agency that runs our weather services in the U.S. Can you talk about how your work has changed how multilingual weather communication is done within the U.S. and how it's compared with what has been done in the past?
You know, when I first began this journey, I actually wanted to be a bilingual broadcaster on television and be able to engage with communities firsthand. But realizing that there wasn't a set infrastructure for multilingual communication across NOAA and the National Weather Service, it was a big mission of mine to begin this research journey in being very applicable to government agencies. And one of the very first successes we had was with the Storm Prediction Center's Categorical Outlook. Some of you may be familiar with it, as it gives you a heads up for severe weather the next coming days and how severe and intense it can be. And there were Spanish translations that would set in at the time, but alluding to some of the conversations we had just a couple of minutes ago, some of those translations were not understood from different kinds of Spanish speakers in Latin America. And it was not communicating the urgency we wanted it to. And so we conducted a nationwide survey of Spanish speakers, evaluated the current system, and evaluated a new one that we proposed alongside sociolinguists. And sure enough, we found that the new one that was based on sociolinguistic backgrounds to really consider those dialects really did engage with those users more. And so we passed it forward to the Storm Prediction Center. And as of just a couple years ago, it's been operationalized and used by broadcast meteorologists across the country. The very first research to operations effort in Spanish, a very historic achievement that has really opened the door for further advancements. More recently, we've been using AI to translate extreme weather information in not just Spanish, but multiple non-English languages, including Vietnamese, French, Samoan, among others, to really try to reimagine how we can reach communities from across the country. And that has been a 5-year-long effort, but we've really invested in training a specific AI in a specific context so that it doesn't confuse, for example, tornado watch into a clock.
So what are some of the risks and limitations in using AI, but also the strengths of going across some of these different products?
When we began this journey in training a specific AI model for extreme weather communication, we did have to consider a lot of these limitations. First off, the fact that there are no terminologies sometimes in these kinds of languages. And so, for example, one of my favorite instances was when the AI translated like atmospheric trough to a trough where pigs eat, for example. And we were just completely missing the point here. Or a rip current in Spanish translated to the word resaca, which means rip current for Spanish speakers, but hangover for the rest of Latin America. And so the dialect nuance is something that an AI is not instantly able to get a hold of, but something, a methodology that we directly use to address that limitation was to have human-in-the-loop functions within this AI. Make sure that bilingual meteorologists and certified translators from the American Translators Association were actively feeding into the model and training it in the proper context of weather and climate so that it does understand this terminology. Another thing too, another limitation is actually not within the AI itself, but our current emergency system. Because when we look at the mobile emergency alerts that we'd receive, sometimes you hear the big vibrating noise with the amber alerts, for example, that system currently doesn't support special characters, which is very important for multilingual communication because sometimes a special character can really displace the kind of meaning for that sort of message. And so it's been very interesting. You know, the FCC recently passed a new standard to have multilingual templates for wireless emergency alerts automated within for the next couple of years by 2028. And as that starts to become a requirement, it's something that our field has been considering. How should we approach and how should we integrate AI in all of this? But I think if we do incorporate that human in the loop function, I think we can achieve more things that we thought we could have never been able to do before.
So thinking to the future, what would you like to see in the next decade to improve multilingual communication for weather?
If I got to dream big, it's to continue investing in this AI service just because it has really transformed the way how we've been able to communicate multilingual communication across the agency. You know, previous to this, it was all based on volunteer translation teams of operational forecasters that already had a lot to do. But this AI has reduced translation time from 1 hour for some forecast products to 2 to 3 minutes. We were inspired a lot actually from Environment Canada, who it is a requirement for them, federal law, to translate into English and French. And the way they do it is they make all of their warnings in English. The automated translation then translates it to French. And just like they have a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week weather office, they also have one for translation services. So those French translators just do some quick fixes, and the English warning comes out, and about 30 seconds later, the French one comes out. If I could dream big, that would be my big dream for the United States, to kind of really use that model. It's been successful in other countries, and I think we could very well advance it here too, to truly create a multilingual communication system that serves those 68.8 million Americans who speak a language other than English at home.
So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Weather Realness, the weekly podcast about weather and climate. Today, we're talking about the intersection between weather and language with Joseph Turiel Falcón, an assistant professor in the University of Illinois Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences. And so one of the unique aspects of your research, instead of the traditional meteorology where we kind of throw information at people and hope it sticks, right, you've been talking to a lot of people. What are some of the most surprising discoveries you've found in talking with people and how they interpret weather information?
You know, I feel like there's been a myth that's been propagated during the last couple of years that sometimes people just simply don't care about weather information. But in these interviews, it really did open my eyes that the contrary was actually correct. People are more than willing to engage with weather information. It's not that they're just aloof and don't want to pay attention to it. The fact of the matter is that it's not implemented in an accessible way. And this is not just for Spanish speakers or any other kind of non-English language speakers. It's also for English speakers as well. People are willing to really engage in this information and really start to process it. We just haven't presented it to them in a way that they can engage with it with. So I think, you know, that was something, a big finding for me that really opened my eyes. And also just really in the multilingual landscape, looking at these indigenous languages, I would have never considered it, but I've really opened my eyes a ton when I talked to the Quiché speaking community out in Mayfield, Kentucky, and even here locally in Urbana-Champaign, when I have had the unique opportunity to interact with the Canjobal speaking community, a Mayan language as well, and to really understand how they contextualize weather risk. For example, for them, sun showers is actually a threat that they... If a sun shower does happen, and for those listening, that is an event where the sun's out, yet it's still raining outside. For them, they have to go inside their homes and really close all of the windows and not interact with it whatsoever, because their culture says that if a raindrop falls during that event on your head, your hair may turn gray. And so when I asked them, what kind of weather needs do you need? They did not even approach me for tornado needs. They were like, can you forecast sun showers by any chance? And I was like, wow, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's just so cool and unique to learn these cultural backgrounds of these different language groups, just to see what they need and how we can tailor it to more engage with them in the future.
So over your career, how has your research changed the way you think about communicating weather risk to communities?
It's really made me so passionate to really center in on the needs of the communities themselves. As you so eloquently mentioned here, you know, for the longest time as meteorologists, we have great intentions to really go out there and reach and serve communities. But we've developed a lot of these products without the consultation of the communities and end users that rely on them just as much. And so, you know, really delving into this field has given me this unique opportunity to listen to the community's needs and really be able to integrate them. And I've been seeing already notable examples, even in the field. You know, one that really warmed my heart was just last year we automated the wireless emergency alerts mobile devices on our phones. And when we interviewed people in the Mayfield tornado, there was one in particular that told me that they were in the third floor of their home, saw a WIA in English, ignored it, but then saw that Spanish WIA message and told their family to go seek shelter in the first floor of their home. When I interviewed this family, the complete third floor of the building was wiped out. It saved their lives, and it was concrete evidence that we were able to do it. It's just something that has made me even more passionate about this topic, and it really continues for me to, as inspiration, to advocate for these communities, because they really need this information, and we got to be there for them.
So thank you for joining us, Joseph.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking with Joseph Turillo Falcón, assistant professor in the University of Illinois Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences. Thanks for joining us today on Weather Realness. Have a weather or climate question you want us to answer? Leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu.
Weather Realness is produced by
Jeff Frame,
Trent Ford,
Steve Nesbitt,
Reginald Hardwick,
Stephanie Orellana, and myself, Maddie Stover. Funding for this podcast is partially provided by the Backlund Charitable Trust. Weather Realness is produced by the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Illinois Public Media. We'll talk with you again next week.